Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Yes, another great show tonight, dealing with metaphysics, spirituality. Tonight, we're going to deal with economies and science about such, and some other issues that have to do with social dynamics, some things that are kind of current at the present time with people out protesting that are saying they don't like the way capitalism works to some extent, and other factors. They also don't like people who have more than they do. Interesting idea. So I, without wasting much time, I thought, I thought we would start with the idea of what is an economy. What is economy? Well, it's part of the seventh type of energy. It deals mostly with the physical world where we live. So if you look at the spectrum of how our universe functions, from the first through the sixth dimensions, economy is of minimal issue. There are some seventh sub-ray issues in those dimensions, but there's no direct major seventh ray effect because there's no physical energy. But here, in this dimension of time and space, it becomes a big issue. And what does it mean? Well, it's the light of the seventh ray we're considering when we talk about what is basic quality. And that light is to cooperate and share with others. So when the light is in form, which we call virtue, when we're creating a virtuous life with others, then there's cooperation and sharing, which is the name of the virtue or the kind of light that we can expect to have produced by doing things that are mostly along the thought of our Creator. Wow, that's a pretty good idea. I like that. Now, when you don't do that, you create forces and all kinds of problems, and it becomes nasty. That's true of any virtue. If you reverse the virtues, you end up with some nasty stuff happening that oftentimes shortens and destroys life and prevents the creation of more of God in everything around us. All right, those are things that we've gone over many times. And if you're a new listener, they may sound new to you, but maybe they don't sound that foreign. The interesting point about this is that economy is part of the means to get to cooperation and sharing. And let me explain how that works. When some person or people is seeking to take their time and energy and to make it a part of other people's time and energy, partly because they wish to have diversity of the outcome of their time and energy. What does that mean? Well, let me give you an example. Let's say that I have 8 hours of my time, and I'm pretty good at waxing cars. Okay, wax on, wax off. But I'm not the greatest at doing some kind of minor surgery that I would like to have done on myself or someone else I know in the near future. So I can choose, if I want to put wax on, wax off for a bunch of hours, 8 hours, and make some money, because I'm pretty good at doing that, you see. Make some money, which is an exchange rate, to pay someone to spend 10 minutes of their time to maybe do some kind of minor surgery, or maybe an hour of their time to do some kind of minor surgery on myself. Now, that's diversity. And diversity is one of the good qualities that comes out of creating virtue in the seventh plane, which is where we live, the physical world. So this is a good thing, because diversity allows others to create in ways that are more unique in their interests and in their abilities, and allows us to do the same. An economy gives us an opportunity to practice in that. Another thing that the diversity eventually leads to is synthesis, which means that if everybody is diverse, or most everybody is diverse from other people, eventually their own talents and creations synthesize with those of others, producing the best of effects. As an example, back to what I was saying, if I'm waxing cars and doing a pretty decent job of it, and someone else is better at doing minor surgery, then it would behoove me to seek the synthesis of our two labors together than to try to do it all myself, because I'd have to learn about surgery most likely to have any success at it, and then I might not be anywhere near as good at it. And so an economy leads to that, and that comes through the diversity between myself and someone else and the synthesis of our activities, leading to this best of outcomes. In other words, those that do the best at something achieve the most and contribute the best and most for the sake of themselves and others. You see how that works? That's a good system. Now, that system of economy requires a few things in it. The first is that it's based upon the individual's ability to be responsible for themselves and to decide what they can and cannot do, and to try to do that which they do best instead of some average or being put into a cone mill and do what everybody else does. Because you can see that goes against the system of diversity and the consequential synthesis that you're seeking to achieve the highest and best use of the seventh ray. Now, I've had people tell me, because I refer to a lot of stuff I've written and to shows, that, well, why can't we just live like people do in the astral realm? They don't have to have an economy, not of any significant amount. Now, that isn't entirely true. If you've read Afterlife Love, you know that that's not the way the astral world is for the most part. It is true, though, that diversity is not as necessary, because most people have enough creative imagination to do a lot of what everybody else can do. And they can do it pretty well. Some people can do some things better, just even in their creative imagination. And some people don't like doing certain things, so they don't. And they allow others to do it for them. So there is an economy of sorts in the astral world, except that the economy is of creative imagination and sense and not money. So it's who's using how much of their creative and creative imagination, which is thought in the astral world, and who is using the most of their senses in any particular application. And that's the money, if you want to call it that, that is used in the astral world. It's a much more in-your-face, dramatic kind of way of expressing one's wealth, because those that have sense have much more ability than those who don't, and it's just a fact. Here, we don't notice that as much, because we do rely upon money as a substitute, because energy slows down so much that it can be concretized into gold, silver, or paper money, something that we have a more imaginative and existential type of reality to, that we tie ourselves with, but it's really a fantasy. It's not true that the money has any intrinsic value, but we believe it to be true, and we live by it, and therefore, for most people, it holds itself out to be. And it allows us to exchange time and energy with others in an efficient fashion. Now, we could we live by exchanging our senses and thought? Very difficult, because we can't even tell how much of that exists from our level of perception here in this dimension. So it wouldn't be very good to have that. And then there's other problems with it as well, which I'm not going to get too deep into because it's not necessary for our understanding of economy here, which is what I'm getting to. Okay, so here is our, we'll say, dilemma, and that is that it requires a considerable amount of individual responsibility and freedom in order to execute a virtuous economy while we're alive in the physical world. It's absolutely required, because if you don't, you end up with an anti-economy, an economy which, instead of getting the most benefit from all the participants in the economy in the most ways, and to increase life and increase our Creator's thought, make it virtuous, make it spiritual, it goes the opposite way. When you decrease the freedom in the economy and you decrease the choices of people, and let's say you control those choices by some government or some powerful group, the result is that there is a stagnation in diversity, a reduction, tremendous reduction in creativity, and the amount of synthesis that takes place is regulated to the point where it is significantly less. That means that you have a very inefficient system of economy. As a matter of fact, it's so inefficient that it inevitably collapses, because it's going against God's thought. And when it collapses, it causes great suffering, loss of life, all the things you would expect from a dark, even evil, kind of system. Those systems include things like communism, some forms of socialism, especially on a large scale. There's some forms of socialism on a very small scale, like in a town or a very small country, that actually have sometimes worked, that people give up some of the diversity and freedom and creativity for a slight improvement in certain types of security. The problem with that is that you're substituting another kind of issue, which is more personal, which has to do with security, for economy. So they're less economical by far, but some people choose, because they're more personally driven than soul driven, usually, in their economies. And it only works on a very small scale. It can't work if you get a big country like here in the United States. But on a very small country level, less than maybe 5 million people, you can actually have socialism that actually can't maintain itself. It's just that the growth is slow. Population growth will be equally slow. Everything goes down. And as long as the people there are satisfied with that result, they're okay. But usually as they develop themselves more and more as souls, they're not satisfied. It's more of a personal kind of pursuit, because the personality seeks control and safety or security. And that becomes its dominant feature. So it likes economies that tend to be towards a socialistic side. But we're here tonight talking about becoming souls. At least that's part of what this show is about. And so for most of the people who are listening tonight, that probably wouldn't be their cup of tea. But nonetheless, it's okay that some people, usually who are less advanced in spiritual sides, move in that direction. Now, there's some kinds of smaller groups of people that are more like tribes or villages that have been successful in a collective kind of economy. But that's desperately getting into a family circumstance. And you can't run countries that way. But as tribes, that might be fun. Might work okay. Again, because there's more of a personal factor. Because family life is strongly influenced by the personality, not so much by the soul. The soul sees all people as part of its family, not just those who belong to its tribe or are related in some genetic or other way to it. All right, so this is. I hope that this is interesting to you. I find this fascinating. Of course, I find a lot of this stuff great and fascinating. But it seems to me that once you start looking into the definitions in metaphysical and scientific, both in economics terms, to what these issues are about, it demystifies them. It brings them out into the open, and you can suddenly say, hey, I'm seeing the light. You know, if we got a big system and it's controlled by the government, it's going kaplooey. And it's going to be really bad for people who are more soul-like, spiritual. Because those folks are most punished by a system that is highly controlled, does not have the diversity and synthesis and the, of course, virtue created, the light, that is inherent in a free market system. Now, I introduced a new term, so I better explain what I mean by that. Yeah, if we're going to talk about a free economy, part of a free economy is the term free market. Now, what is a free market? Free market means that each person can determine the value of their goods and services that they create, obviously, for themselves, and not by created or interfered with by anybody else. Why is that so important? Why is it so important to have free market? Well, if you don't have free market, your economy inevitably is never free. So free markets are really the basis, starting point of a free economy. It isn't the only thing. And free markets, when I talk about free markets, I'm not just talking about price controls or wage controls. I'm talking about anything the government or some other controlling group does to prevent the ability to freely create oneself into the economy. And so any ruthless or destructive or controlling regulations that limit or even eliminate certain abilities to be freely selling one's goods and services then destroys the concept of a free market, and that destroys a free economy. That's why you may have heard some people, usually more towards the right politically in the United States, saying, well, with all these regulations, no business can really make much money or survive. And it's the same concept, basically. Words like more regulations, more controls, it's just the same thing. Now, does that mean that a free market should work with no rules? No. Absolutely not. As a matter of fact, in order for a market to be free, you have to have a level playing field. And things like monopolies or destructive practices that destroy or steal from others by taking things in the environment and destroying them, because that's theft from everybody else when you think about it. So if you are allowed to excessively pollute the world, then you're stealing from everybody the beauty and livability, viability of the world. And so it's okay to make rules against doing things like that. But if you micromanage that, or if you get down to the level where the rules do much more harm than they do any good, then at that point, you're just using the word of rules to usually advance another cause entirely. oftentimes communism or some type of extreme socialism. Those things are not good. Those things should be banned or prevented from happening. Now you can say, well, what about, how do you know something's good or bad? Well, there are ways to determine it. You determine it by the most amount of good for the most amount of people, produced in the sense of economy, it would come out to the most amount of diversity with the most amount of synthesis, and the most amount of creativity with the least amount of losses of those same things and others, including life, including human life, but other kinds of life, in the world. And that includes beauty. And it includes other kinds of virtues. So the result is that you can figure these things out. It takes enormous amounts of consciousness to do so. You have to be able to really think big. But if we put our better thinkers doing this, it's possible to come up with reasonable rules. Not all of them will work just because somebody says they're a genius or acts that way and comes up with an idea, because it may fail. So you want to do it on a small scale and test all the rules that you make rather than doing it on a national, or worldwide scale that may destroy countless businesses' lives and who knows what else. So all these things have to be done with great care. But still, rules make sense. Why is a monopoly a bad idea? Well, it's not a level playing field. A monopoly, it gives some one person the ability to disrupt the creativity and prevent the diversity and synthesis that's so important to economy. It's a matter of fact, by its definition, monopoly does the opposite. So obviously you have rules against monopolies. Now, the nitty-gritty of the problem is that when does something become monopoly? Well, sometimes you can look at it from how much percentages people or business has of a particular market, but sometimes that's not a good way of looking at a monopoly. Probably the best way is how easy is it or difficult for others to be creative in that environment, within that area of economy. If it's very difficult and it's caused by the monopoly, monopoly's got to be busted up, and then it has to be restructured so that there are smaller businesses that can't be monopolizing the amount of material or labor or whatever else it's doing, including trying to get the government to make rules against its competitors. All of those things have to be eliminated. That's normal, and that should be done. So rules are important, but excessive government regulation is very bad and can be used as a weapon, as I just said, even by monopolies, and commonly is, by the way. All right, what about labor unions? I wanted to kind of strike a note on this, because right now a lot of the folks that are going protesting, these are younger people for the most part, are being affected by labor unions. Some of them are being directly paid to go protest. Maybe a third to half of them are actually getting money or food or other kinds of remuneration for their protesting. I don't like that idea. But be as it may, where does the money come from? It mostly comes from unions, sometimes from others. George Soros likes to stir the pot, and so he sends out millions of dollars to make these things also happen. He's a strange dude. At any rate, getting back to the point I'm trying to make here, and that is that unions have a dual role. The first is to allow workers to use their collective ability to work within a certain industry to allow them to negotiate agreements for all of themselves. That's the concept behind a union. But you notice that that concept is somewhat contradictory to the concept of economy. Why is that true? Because the union assumes that all of the people's labor are to be averaged together, and that the individual doesn't matter anymore. It's the collective. problem with the present concept of unions is that. Now you say, well, how can you have a union if you're not going to average the collectiveness of labor? Well, you can, and I'll explain. The way you can do it is the following. The union has the right to organize its members, but it still organizes its members by their ability to work, and it fights for their pay based upon those abilities in terms of time and energy. And it ensures that people are treated fairly with similar or the same abilities as far as their value to the employer. That would be a great union. That union or those unions set up on that model would be amazingly effective in helping our economy to grow and protecting the rights of the individual workers. But the way it is today, it's very close to communism. And as a matter of fact, the unions, if you look at it, are almost, most of the bosses of the unions are declared or non-declared, but they acted communists because they're practicing communism. So the issue here then becomes this. You know, workers of the world unite. It shouldn't be workers of the world unite. It should be individuals of the world unite to gain the same relative strength in negotiation, pay, appreciation, everything, as someone of equal value as an individual, but not collectively because they're just members of a group. And this is a very interesting concept. I don't know how often, if ever, it's been tried. But it is the future of unions. How do I know that? Because it's the right thing. It's the light. We may be hundreds of years away from unions becoming those things or anything else like them. But it's much better than our present system because the present system degrades the economy and holds back the growth of business and the growth of jobs. When you unionize on collectivation, you reduce ultimately the number of jobs and you increase the salary of all at the detriment of those who are the best. Wow. Now, you may disagree with me, and that's okay. I don't mind people disagreeing with what I'm saying. But what I'm trying to explain, I think, has a lot of thought to be concerned about with it, in that it's worthwhile to be saying, well, you know, maybe this guy has got saying stuff that isn't all that crazy. Because I'm trying to expose the truth about what these institutions and ideas and ways of producing economy are really like, so that we can see them for what they are. Now you can say, well, gee, isn't it true like 8-10% of the United States workforce are unionized? And if you're listening from another country, in your country, it's probably much higher than that. And that makes a very inefficient economy. Worse than unions, though, is government, direct government control over major parts of the economy. That produces even worse results than unionization, because unionization still has to battle with the structure of collective bargaining with an employer, unless it's a public union. That's worse, because those unions have much more power, because they use their power to control the government, and they get their power from the government, so it's one hand washing the other. But in a private situation, it's more equal. And so the unions are somewhat limited in their power. But the government, once it starts getting involved in this business, man, that's bad news. Because the government doesn't have any controls that give it even a signal what it's doing may be wrong. This is what's happened under our present administration here in the United States. The Obama administration is a socialist administration, whether you want to believe it or not. And Obama is a Marxist. Now, he doesn't refer to himself that way, but he went to a church that's like that for 20-some-odd years. And all of his friends are openly stating they're Marxists. And many of the people that he has in his administration are members of the Communist Party or are members of a related group that no longer uses the name Communist Party, like Code Pink or something else like that. But it's still the same thing, you know. It's a means to do several issues. The first is to completely manage and control, centrally control, the economy. Now, it's more than just socialism. Socialism tries to control the major industries, and Obama started doing that right away. But the reason he hasn't finished, other than the fact he's hopefully not going to be president again, but the reason hopefully he's not going to move ahead with his plan is because the next step is to adopt a much more rigid view of the economy in terms of communism. That's wage and price controls. That becomes loss of most freedoms. And probably the worst thing of all, which most people don't recognize, is communism, by definition, states that God and religion is the opiate of the masses, is a means of convincing people to follow something that isn't true, which is God. And it's about as dark and evil a system as you can get in our present political environment. I know what that means if I'm saying that he's one of them, but that's what I'm saying. So it is an interesting problem because the paradigm itself has many dangers in it. And you start, usually when you want to take over a country, and if you're a communist, you don't start off being a communist because it's extremely radical. You want to take all the rights away from people. You want to control not just major industries. You want to control everything about their lives. So you start off, and you've got to be a narcissist and a kind of an egomaniac and a tyrant if you're going to do all this stuff. Obviously, that's what we would call someone who wants that. But the bigger problem isn't what you call it. The bigger problem is what happens to the lives of people. You start having a decrease in wealth and a redistribution deliberately imposed by the government on the wealth through socialism. Now, socialism does not have to redistribute wealth, but when it's joined with, when you take the beginnings of socialism and you start redistributing wealth, you now have shown that you're going to really move towards communism, because that's what communism imposes. But it's never true. It doesn't really redistribute wealth, not in the real sense. What it does is it takes wealth from the existing wealthy and it gives it to the people who are the communists. And then the rest of the people, including the people who used to be wealthy, become relatively poor. And you have really just two classes. You have the controlling communist class, and then you have most of the rest of the people who are pretty much poor. There really is no more middle class. And communists almost always proclaim that they're the great saviors of the middle class. They are the destroyers of the middle class. So it's an interesting dilemma. And when we have an economy that is starting to move in that direction, as has happened in the United States, you end up with a decline in real income, a destruction of the higher classes economically of people, which usually leads to a severe lack of creativity, a reduction in entrepreneurship, a almost total elimination of venture capital, which is what causes new things to be created, including new kinds of jobs. And it leads to a dictatorship. Its purpose is not so much economic as its needs are for those who enact it to be in control of others, because they think they deserve to be in control. They think they're better than everybody else. And that's why they're narcissistic and arrogant and generally bad people. So it's a great concern that we have the beginnings of this going on. I think it can still be stopped. But most people don't know what I'm saying to be true. If you're interested in the real intellectual side of what I'm saying, read a book called The Road to Serfdom. Kind of a scary book if you read it, because it kind of exposes what I'm saying, but at a much higher level than what I'm talking at. And it's a little heady, but it's a great book. It was written in the 40s, and still worthwhile to read today. And it was about the socialism of that time. But that was the socialism of fascism and communism, etc. Remember, socialism is the first step in the direction towards these terrible dictatorships. You always start with socialism because it seems like it's such a good idea. You know, hey, we know how to run the government better. The economy better than everybody else, so we'll just do it for you. And then they start with redistribution. Remember, redistribution is not necessarily part of socialism. Redistribution is a part of communism. So don't get confused by that. So when people say, I'm here to redistribute your wealth, what they're really saying is I'm going to take from you things that I don't want you to have, and I'm going to keep them for myself and give them to my friends. That's what they're saying. All right. So where do we go with this economy that we're talking about? If you're started on the road, hopefully we're going to get off this road. Well, once you start on the road of socialism with redistribution, which is a very serious offense when the two are joined together, the results almost immediately, I mean like within 6 months, a year, is that you drive all of the growth out of the economy. So the numbers that we call growth numbers, where they say, oh, GMP went up by 4%, 3%, 5%, whatever, those go down almost zero. They usually stay somewhere between like 0.5% and 1.5%. And the more you redistribute the wealth, the lower that number goes. Okay. Socialism in itself will not drive the number much below 1%, but the increase in redistribution of wealth will. And eventually it will get into negative numbers and you're in recession, and eventually you'll be in a depression. And then you'll be in a chronic depression, much as happened in the Soviet Union or other countries that are communistic. Now, someone's going to say, oh, well, what about the Chinese? You know, all that stuff. Well, China eventually will collapse, but it's going to take 100 years. Why will it collapse? Because it has certain elements of a free market system, but it does involve socialism to a high degree, with moderate levels presently of redistribution of wealth. The reason it's not as noticeable as a problem is because China is coming from almost feudal economy into a more modern semi-capital economy. It's not free markets by any stretch. The government's picking almost everything that happens from behind the scenes. But on the surface, there's enough free market to keep growth very high while the population is growing in its wants and needs and willing to become a manufacturer for the rest of the world at relatively low wages. That's not going to remain like that forever. And as more and more of their system becomes middle class, it'll start failing, and they won't be able to continue to make things as cheaply, similar to what happened in Japan in the 50s and 60s. Although Japan had a free market system, but they were very low due to the war and other things. And at first they could manufacture things cheaply and export them, etc. And then eventually their products became more expensive than just about anybody else's. So this similar kind of events will take place in China. China is kind of unique, but it's doomed for failure in its present model. It's just going to take some time. There's a lot of other problems in its model, which are even more severe in the political side, But I'm not going to get into that tonight because we're talking about economy. Well, I'll tell you what. We're going to take a break for right now. And we'll come back in about 2 minutes and 30 seconds, give or take, and talk a lot more about this whole idea of free economy versus a controlled one and see where it all leads to. So I'll be back in a couple of minutes from right now.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. M-A-C-F-L-O-U-E-R.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
We're back. This is Why Life Is. I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight we're talking about free economy versus controlled economy. And I think I'm going to touch on a lot of different areas, some of which may be of interest to everybody, some may be of particular interest to just some. But I want to cover this subject well enough so that when you get off, you can say, gee, I really understand some things about economy and people and other things, because we're going to get into people, too. Matter of fact, why don't I start with that? I think it's kind of interesting. The people that are running around right now, majority of them are younger. But I mean, there's some older folks with them, too. But it's mostly younger folks. Now, some of them are getting paid to protest. Man, when I was young, we never got paid to protest. It cost us money. How did they work that one out? See, they must understand something about the economy that I don't. But okay, so they're getting paid by SEIU and several other more communistic-type groups to go out and protest because they want the protests to change the environment. But that change that they're looking for is not truly to get rid of Wall Street, whatever. It's to get to socialism with redistribution, which leads to communism. So what these folks are really looking to do is to change the United States economy into a communistic system. And one way to do this is through protests that lead to revolution that eventually, you know, challenges enough people so that people are intimidated by these quote-unquote protesters. Chances of that happening in this day and age in the United States, slim and none. If the present administration stays in another 4 years, chances of it happening are fair to good. So you better hope that they don't stay in power. The reason for it is this, that at the present time, our president yesterday and today said, hey, these folks are really good people. I like them. They're communists, just like I am. I think I have a comrade moment. You know, we can all hug each other and sit around the fire. It's cool. He thinks they're really good for us. Well, of course, they're good for him. And the reason the danger goes way up if he gets into a second administration is if you think that the things that have happened so far have been radical and extreme. That's nothing compared to what's coming. And then these folks become a part of the whole system to try to change us into first more and more socialism with greater and greater levels of redistribution of wealth and then full-blown communism. That's what we're headed for. And it would take at least about another 4 years to achieve it. And that's especially true if he didn't win a majority in the House and the Senate as he had the first couple of years. So, I mean, it would take at least the 4 years. Now, if we go back in time and we got that, if the president got the other two sides of government together, we're pretty well in big trouble. Because then everything could change in 1 or 2 years. And that would be very, very dangerous. I just don't think it's going to happen. I think that enough people are waking up. They may not understand everything I'm talking about, but people are waking up and they're going to go for this. I hope not. Now, let's talk about the founders. I'm going to mention the founders for a minute. The founders of this country were free market folks. Were they capitalists? For the most part, yes. Were any of them collectivists? In the sense of, like, communists. Now, communism didn't exist as a word at the time of the inception of the United States. But were they in that vein? Not really. Not if you look at the people who signed the Declaration of Independence or the people at the first congressional convention in the designing of our Constitution. How do you know that? Because you can read about their biographies and you can see what they wrote to each other and what were their concerns. Well, their greatest concern was in government itself, and that government would control everything in people's lives. And so they were trying to prevent that from happening. Now, here's an interesting part of the point in the whole situation, and that is that you can't have a controlled economy unless you have a very controlling government. So, and these folks were against the controlling government to begin with, so they didn't even have to get the square two. They didn't have to say, gee, we don't want a controlling economy. They didn't want any controlling government, and there wouldn't be any controlling economy otherwise. So that's another way of looking at who they were and what their belief structure was and why that belief structure is as I'm explaining it to you. Now, why is that important for us to consider? Well, these folks are pretty smart people. Most of them were higher level initiates for their time, and meaning spiritually endowed people with great thinking abilities, probably as good as you could find in most of the rest of the world, right here in the United States, all living together. What a great opportunity, and not by chance. So they represent, in human terms, an enlightened group, and this enlightened group came up with some fantastic ideas that some have been cut away or dismantled, and that's where our dangers lie. If we just adhered to what was originally designed, we'd be in a lot better shape today, but we haven't. We've curtailed some of them, somewhat through the court system, somewhat through Congress itself, and somewhat from ignoring the Constitution or laws that still exist. That being the case, it would really help us to start going back to some of the things that they said and see how they do apply today and make them more more understood and more enforced as what they are, which is a control or restriction on government. Okay, so economy is inversely responsive to the ability for government to control in general. Inversely responsive. As the government becomes more and more controlling, especially when you get beyond the necessary rules to keep an economy a level playing field and one that isn't destructive to life and other people's liberties, then at that point, it's inversely proportionate in terms of the amount of good it produces. So bigger governments destroy economies. They eat up the assets of the economy. They become, under their own weight, destructive to the whole economy because they use up so much of the resources of the economy. And for the most part, government does not create jobs. It actually takes them away from the private sector. It doesn't create wealth. It takes that away from the private sector as well. It's just an illusion that certain economists came up with somewhat in the 20s and 30s to get us to believe otherwise. So it's important for us to see the truth of this situation. And let's go back to the folks out on the street now. Those folks believe pretty much the opposite of what I've said tonight. Where does this lead them? Well, there's an odd consequence for someone who chooses the path of redistribution, leading to communism, etc., is that they almost inevitably become the victims, the first victims of the system. Almost inevitably. And the reason is that these are the folks who don't have the driving ambition to be part of the upper class, and since there's no more middle class, they just become the slaves or serfs. That's right. All those folks that are out there protesting, getting freebies from SEIU and dozens of other groups, including MoveOn.org, which is controlled by George Soros, and all these other groups, all those folks are destined for destitute. Yes, they'll be on the doles. There's no question about that. But their life will be shattered into fragments of what it could be. They'll have little creation, great deal of sorrow, tremendous boredom, and tediousness. And a life with no God. Because most of these folks, if they aren't already, are destined to become atheists. So this is where they're headed to. Now, why would I say that about the atheists? Because, again, God wants us to be free and helps in many ways for that to be produced. But if you're into the more communistic side of existence, communism in itself says God is bad, there is no such thing, it's the opiate of the masses, etc. You go back and read Marx and Engels. But it also, even if it didn't say that, it does it. It gets rid of the ability for people to be self-created. And it makes them created in the image of government and those running the government. All right, so this is a big deal. Now, when we look at the bottom line of this thing, the folks out there doing all the protesting are sealing their fate, in a sense, if they succeed, which I don't think they will in this particular case. But if they were to succeed, they would be victimized. Their life would be destroyed. And partly because they'll go along with all the programs the government introduces, all of the free giveaways. They'll make themselves into welfare cases, They'll buy their food with food stamps. Of course, the food they buy won't be the food they choose. It'll be the food the government chooses for them to eat. And on and on and on. Even the freedoms that we take for granted today will be mostly gone. Somewhere down the line, they'll learn a lesson out of it. How and when, and to what extent that will make a difference. It's hard to say. Why are young people so prone to this? Well, it has to do with the nature of development. We tend to think that people are adults at 21. They're really not spiritually developed until about 28. And spiritual development is more important than mental and personal development. They may be developed because they're approaching 20, some of them. Others are only 15, 16. Others are maybe 23, 24. The point is, if you took the majority of them, they'd be in those age groups. And what's peculiar about that age group, or some of the older folks that are in their 30s or 40s even, that may have still in common because they haven't grown up yet themselves, is that they're in rebellion to their family and to the concept of having somebody tell them what to do. Isn't that weird? Because the government's going to step in and run their life for them, but they don't know that right now. They think they'll be more free if they stay in the streets protesting, getting meager amounts of food and money to do so, and they have camaraderie with their friends, and they seem self-important. The problem is they're being used as puppets for a bigger goal of changing the country. And they don't know that. They say they want change, but the change they want is exactly the opposite of what they're going to end up getting. The change they want is they want to be free themselves. And they think they're not free because they are still in a rebellious attitude against various members of their family, parental figures, in society. And they're still adolescents, even though they, some of them in number of years, chronologically speaking, are not. Some of us just don't grow up as fast. And when you don't grow up, you feel like other people are scary to you. And you want to have some control and power over them. And you want to have what they already have achieved without having to work for it. I mean, why not? If you can get it, and if somebody says they'll give it to you, and that you deserve it on top of it, just because you're really a cool person, and because you're willing to go out and protest for it. This is the reality of these folks. I'm not saying everyone. I'm taking an average. The psychology behind it is immaturity. The majority of these people are emotionally immature. Some of them are also mentally immature. And virtually every one of them is spiritually impoverished. How do I know they're spiritually impoverished? Because they're seeking a system that by itself and of itself seeks to eliminate God, communism. You see, you don't have to know a lot to be able to figure that out. It's not really like, oh, gee, I wonder how he knows that. Well, no, it's right in your face kind of thing. Some of them are openly anti-Semitic and have other anti-positions. Where does that come from? Well, the reason you see others as being so negative to yourself is because you yourself don't feel good about who you are. And so it makes you feel better to disparage other people. And that's where all of this terrible language comes from that you may have heard from some of these folks in the last few days. The anti-Semitism is really strange because it deals so much with the Wall Street issue that Jews are really just very wealthy people who are taking advantage of everybody else. It seems a little strange to me, but nonetheless, that is part of the perspective. the Jew to some of these folks is all of the bad qualities of both their parents, maybe a few thousand other people that they may know, that they project their parents onto. I mean, it's like the Jew is the bad part of their parent. Very strange stuff. All right, so it's immaturity of a pretty gross nature. And how does it happen? Well, we raise our children with the promiscuity as part of their existence, a lack of virtue being part of their schooling, because they go to public schools where they usually are banned from anything about God. And they don't have any moral compass. They don't have any ethics. Or if they do, it's limited by certain prejudices that may be familiar, but they may just pick up along the way. This is a bad problem because you mix immaturity with these other qualities, and you end up with people with pretty significant immaturity plus personality disorder. And that creates a lot of issues. People who are violent, willing to prevent others from exercising freedom and rights, and believe they have a right to do that. It's unfortunate. It's sort of, it's like a criminality, but it isn't the criminality that some types of personality disorder is more often found in. This is a criminality about not caring about others as people. And so they're more prone towards violence, and they're more prone towards prejudice because they don't see other people as people. They see them as objects. All of this is behind these movements, especially the communist movement. They take people like this who are the damaged goods, the children of a specific generation, which was given too much, not taught God in their life, sent to the wrong kinds of educational places where God didn't exist, and where the education itself is twisted to be anti-capitalistic. And then we wonder how and why they come out so crazy and so seemingly irrational in their arguments. The answers are pretty simple. It's like you're baking a cake and you put all the wrong ingredients in, it's going to come out pretty lousy. And that's what happened. It happened because in the last couple of generations that have grown up in this country, a generation being every 20 years or so, we've had a lot of them brought up in a way which is poor. Some of it also comes from families lacking a strong couple of parents. Sometimes there's no parent that's strong. Sometimes there's one that's sort of and the other one maybe not there or very weak. This produces a lot of problems in children. And no matter what you tell the children, if they live with these problems, they become a magnifier of the problems in themselves, and you end up with these kinds of issues. But remember, children have always been rebellious. Their nature is to rebel against authority, usually starting around age 12 to 14 and on. So it gets pretty hairy. But the mitigating elements for most children in past generations has been that there have been other parts of the society that have helped out. Our society is falling apart in those other parts, especially in this administration that exists now, because it's so anti-God, and it is so, unfortunately, dark in its economic views, which coincide with its need for power and control. Okay, so does that mean that every administration was better than it? Not necessarily. It just means that we need a better administration now. We need a better president, a better Congress. We We've voted some better people in this last time into Congress. But it isn't about being a Republican over a Democrat. It's about being a person who believes in the things I'm talking about in the show, which have to do with virtuous ideas and virtuous ways of living. If you believe in that, that's the more important issue. I don't care if you're a Democrat or whatever you call yourself. If you're virtuous in your life, that's what's important. Very important. Okay, so the young folks out there have these deficiencies, and they are going to be the slaves of these groups that are running them and paying at least some of them. And this is all planned out months and months ago. As a matter of fact, I remember seeing a show by Glenn, several of them, by Glenn Beck at the beginning of this year. That's a long time ago, where he predicted all of this was going to happen. Now, I don't know if you're a lover of Glenn Beck. Of course, he's not on Fox right now. It's his own station. I haven't gotten a chance to see it. But the fact that he predicted this was going to happen, and he predicted it right now, shows that this was planned a long time ago, because he claims that he got this from inside sources, and I believe it to be true. I have found most of what this man has said to be uncannily true. Scary, too. That doesn't mean that everything he says is correct. It just means that he's got people that are telling him what's being planned, that are spies, so to speak, inside the government, and are willing to reveal to him what's happening. I think that's a worthwhile person to have. I like whistleblowers. Good idea. Okay. So, let's deal more with the economy itself. We'll leave the younger, immature folks alone for now. And talk about how do you move from where we are or where the world is, which some parts of the world much worse than the United States. I'm sure many listeners realize that. But we've been moving quickly in that direction. How do we solve it? I mean, already we've got so many countries that have become highly socialized. They call them socialistic democracies, but they're not even democracies. They're really pre-communist countries. And then some that are just overtly communist, like, oh, Mr. Chavez, Hugo. Oh, you know, he's got his own deal going on there in South America, and he loves it. Why does he love it? What is there about Venezuela and all any of these countries that is a hallmark for creating a communist state? And they all pretty much do it the same way. And then how do we undo those kind of places? Well, the first thing to consider here is that those countries are usually countries that have not been given a fair shake in the worldwide community. Now, why is that? It has to do with the leaders that in the past have run those countries seeking to form alliances, and I'm talking about before they went communistic now, and with powers like the United States. And then to the interest of the other countries, they form pacts, or, you know, we'll call them treaties, including trade treaties, that benefits the wealthy and the controlling members of the society in each of the two countries, but especially true in the totalitarian-natured South American countries. Now, even if they have some democracy, the people buy their control in the government, and it's hard to get them out. And they get it from aligning themselves with countries like the United States. So what does the United States have to do? We've got to change ourselves, because we're the leading country, and then not make deals with crooked leaders. I don't care if it's in China, Venezuela, Cuba, North Korea, Iran, and on and on. Doesn't matter. We make deals with those folks, all we're doing is building up the devil, making a deal with the devil. And I know some people say, well, trade's good. It'll allow them to become more like us. It never has. When you trade with them, they just become more wealthy, more militaristic and strong, and they learn how to manipulate us, and we corrupt their political system internally far worse by keeping the people in power more in power by strengthening their economy at the cost of their own people. So the United States and other leading countries have a lot to do with changing this worldwide problem by not supporting it to begin with. We should support freedom and free markets and free political systems and more than just democracy, true Republican kinds of systems. Now, I talk about the party now. I'm talking about where it's a republic, where people can choose to have honest people represent them in some circumstances. And a lot of other issues that can be helpful in terms of the politic. If we're going to make a change in other countries, we're going to have to make a change here, too. So that's what I'm trying to say. But yes, we can help these other countries to get away from their dictators, to move away from the extreme anti-God nature of their existence. It's tough. I think that it would help for the United States people, forget about our government, to form private groups to help deal with these countries, including North Korea, to help them become free. Because the government of the United States is not doing it because we're corrupt. So we need to probably take it on ourselves on a private level. And there's all kinds of ways that we could help induce much more freedom in even the worst of countries such as North Korea. Even eventually China, which would be much more difficult, by the way. But nonetheless, we have that capability if we choose to, and it would make the world a lot better place. And it would also increase the wealth of everybody. When you have countries that are so subjected, it decreases the wealth. Just the way communism decreases the wealth within a country, it decreases the wealth within all countries in the world. Wow. So we have a worldwide problem, not just a national or a group of country problem. It's worldwide. It's affecting all of us in some way, in some serious ways, actually. Something to be greatly concerned about. All right. What else can be done then that is going to make some significant improvements? Well, I think it would be good that the economy, as I have brought it up tonight, and a lot more, by the way, I'm not expecting that what I say tonight is a full understanding for somebody about economy, but pretty much in the way that I've addressed it, economy should be taught in school. You ever wondered why a lot of this stuff is never taught to anybody? In order to learn about it, you got to go to college, and then you got to specialize in the economy. And then you have to take a lot of other core courses before you can take those economic courses because they're so hard. I mean, there's something really wrong with this, right? Now, it's more than just economy. It's also metaphysical principles, ontological, cosmological issues that go into, come into play, and philosophical, about the meaning of life, what life is about, what God is about. All of these things become part and parcel of what people need to learn. Now, that doesn't mean that they have to accept it. I'm completely okay with anybody saying, going into a classroom and saying, I'm a communist, and this is why I believe in it. And they should try to support their position, and others talk about it and discuss it with them. That's okay. Ideas are all right. It's the implementation of them to the exclusion of other people's that's the problem. All right. So we take a look at the situation, and there's a severe lack of education about all the things so far I've talked in the show about. I mean, almost every one of them is missing from both elementary and junior high and high school and even the beginnings of college. It's just missing. Can't find it. Most people are clueless about this stuff. So that's how you end up with kids going out in the street and protesting goofy things, because they don't know better. And that's how Hugo Chavez gets control of a whole country, because the people don't know any better. And that's how the world suffers, because of ignorance. And because people aren't taught to think, they're taught to state back what they're told, at best. Which is not really education. It's brainwashing. All right, so we've got education is a really important element in this. And I would say, let's get it going here, in this country. That's, we'll be a model for what it really takes. It's okay for kids to talk about why capitalism may not work in this situation or that situation, to investigate all models for themselves, to determine what's right and what's wrong for humanity, including themselves, and to realize that others need to always be free to choose what they want. All right, I just found out my mic wasn't working too good there. Hopefully, I'm right on top of it now, so hopefully you can hear me tonight. Maybe I'm losing my voice. Who knows? All right, but I'm right up against the mic, so that can help. Evidently, they were losing me, so they got back on to tell me. So I don't know where we stopped at, but education is a critical element in this process of helping to change the system. If you don't teach people at a fairly young age some of these concepts, then as they grow older, they're susceptible to falsehoods and to other people trying to offer them payoffs for not being responsible for their own lives. And then the other thing that comes to mind here, it sort of as a parallel to education, is the idea that people need the opportunity at a young age to be creative and free to explore their creativity, which, again, is not done very well in schools, but it isn't done very much any place anymore. We're kind of like people who sit in front of screens and tend to do virtually nothing most of the time. This needs to change as well. The joy of creation is a amazing joy, one that can be for at least most people the real benefit of being alive. But co-creating with your creator is another step entirely. And that is another part of what's missing. When people are spiritually focused, when they have an understanding, even if it's rudimentary, that God exists to them, not because somebody else tells them. They have to find it for themselves. They're not going to go become communists. It's not going to happen. They're not even going to get near that. And you're not going to be able to convince them to. And hopefully they can all hear me now. I'm as close to this mic as I can get without eating it, literally. And so these are critical elements of how to make some changes in the process. Now, I would also suggest that in places that don't have these kinds of freedoms and they're bringing up their population to be slaves, that we invoke, you know, like we used to have, I don't know how much we have of it anymore, but like Radio Free Europe or Radio Free this or that. We start getting to some of the people in those countries and teaching them ourselves over the objections necessarily of maybe their leaders, and who cares? I wouldn't care about their leaders. I would be concerned about doing what's right for everyone, seeing all people as souls and being given the opportunity to become free. That's probably the single most important element. If you look at the founders, going back to that concept again of the United States, their biggest concern was freedom, because it's the first part of God's mind. I don't know if they could have explained it that way, but I think a lot of them could have, particularly the ones who were Masons, by the way, Freemasons. But the thing that is so critical is that you have to want it for everybody else and not just for yourself. Because if you want it only for yourself, then you'll never have it, because only when all people are free in an economy that is working does the economy itself work. And if you only want it for yourself and you don't want the other people to be free, it causes the economy to decline. And eventually you will lose your own wealth in the process. Isn't that fascinating? I kind of find it just amazing that you know, people who say, well, all the rich people are taking all the money. First of all, it's not a zero-sum situation. When rich people get rich, everybody gets somewhat wealthier. But when rich people try to prevent other people from getting wealthy, they become poorer over time. It's hard to understand, isn't it? It's true, because it's not zero-sum. It's based upon the concepts of what? You got to have synthesis. Well, who's going to synthesize anything if there's only the rich people who have everything and nobody else has anything else? You see how that works? That's a kind of fascinating idea. And you're not going to have Okay, it turns out we had an electronic problem. It wasn't my voice. No, I could lose my voice too, but I'm right on top of this mic, and it turned out that it was something else on the line, in the line, you never know. And so apparently I'm sounding okay now, but I was going away there for a while. My voice was just trailing away and breaking up, and I was hearing weird things in my headset too. So something was wrong on that line. Hopefully we got it going now. We got a different line and everything seems to be working. All right, so back to what I was saying. We'll get this down. All right. So without diversity, there won't be any diversity, because they're all people are in these countries that are controlled are basically slaves, and they're like mechanized robots, and then, you know, they just say what they're told to say and do what they're told to do. And in those situations, the economy suffers immensely. Eventually, even those in power that have all the money, they can't even maintain their standard of living, at least at the highest levels that they used to, and they will fail. All of some of the countries we've seen go down, West, East Germany, the old Soviet Union, and a whole bunch of other examples. So if we're going to be really open about the situation, only when all do well will all continue to do well. And if only some do well, then eventually everyone suffers. But that doesn't mean you can have a collective system. No, you can't have a collective system. It's not permitted. The only thing you can have is individuals who create within their own rights and their own abilities, and the system has to work within itself. So that's how it's designed. And if you don't like that system, I guess you can send your complaint mail to God. Because God said, each will be self-created and not controlled by anyone or anything else. If it's godly, if it's light. I'm still hearing a little noise on this line, but I hope that everybody's hearing me okay. Okay, I'm back again. We changed to another line this time. Doesn't mean that it's going to solve the problem, but I'm going to keep trying. That's part of, I'll just wrap it right into the show. You've got to be tenacious, and you got to keep going even in the face of sometimes obstacles and even defeat in this world. That's part of God's gift to us, is that the world doesn't come to us. We have to go to it. We have to find solutions to major problems. We have to sometimes deal with the stubbornness and even destructiveness of evil. Yeah, I know about that. I'm going to tell you I know about that. And you've got to be able to withstand that and to fight back sometimes and also to create back and to come to what we'll say a realization that we are here to make a difference, every one of us. Sometimes that difference is relatively small, and sometimes it's huge. And you may not know what your difference is until you get involved in it and find out for yourself. It's somewhat hidden because when we come into this world, we, unlike in a controlled economy, have a clean slate. We can do anything we want to do. And if we put our minds to it and our heart into it, and if we have capabilities, we can create for ourselves both wealth and great meaning in life. That's the good news. The bad news is there's no guarantee that anything's going to happen. And we might do a lot in terms of our efforts and get very little in terms of our results. That's entirely possible. There's no guarantee about either. We just don't know. So these are some of the things that I think we should consider if we're going to consider whether we want to go for a free economy. And my suggestion is to consider the following solutions beyond what I've already covered. A free economy means that we consider that an asset in and of itself and something that be cherished, I'm going to suggest that maybe we need a constitutional amendment. I suggested this a few months ago, I know, for those of you who are listening, and that supports a free economy, a free market system, and says that no president, no government can interfere beyond a certain point in the free market nature of our system. And that for those people who seek to express some other kind of system, they can live elsewhere. You know, they don't have to live here. There's nobody forcing them to live here. They can go someplace else. There's lots of other places that don't have that system. Now, why would I want to suggest that when, if we're free people, we shouldn't have to have it put into an amendment to our Constitution? And the reason is this. Even though 98% of the people might agree with that, it only takes a couple percent of the people in the wrong places at the wrong time, or the right time for them anyway, to disrupt and even destroy our economy. It's fragile enough that that can be done if a person has enough power in today's world and in our government. That's why I would say we need it. That's something, I don't know if we're going to come to that realization after this last bout now with socialism, etc. I don't know if we really will, but I think something is in order to have to be done about this, and that's one possibility. I don't like rules and laws even as amendments, but if the amendment is that we need to be free, kind of makes sense to me. You know, but is freedom to say what is the best economic system? Well, maybe. Maybe. Depending upon how much of us can come to an agreement that freedom in economy, diversity in economy, synthesis in economy, and an economy that follows and works only in a free market is a system we want only for ourselves. I don't know. It'd be interesting to float that amendment to see how many people would go for that. I think it's a vast majority, but maybe I'm wrong. We would have to see. Okay, so what else can we do then to improve upon the present circumstances to allow us to become more of a dynamic system in terms of our economy? Well, one of the things that I think is relevant is we need a monetary system that is never digitized and that cannot be manipulated. That means probably significantly modifying or eliminating, I don't know which, the Federal Reserve. Why? Well, because the Federal Reserve changes the monetary system at will by printing more money, it's called digitizing, or sometimes by restricting money supply, or sometimes by literally altering the value of the money you already have without necessarily making new money. You didn't know they could do that, but there's ways they have that they could do that. And so the monetary system is unstable. Now, who wins in an unstable monetary system? The people who want to change it. The people who want to change the economy always want an unstable monetary system. The people who started this were people called progressives, of which some Democrats are included, in which Obama is one of them. And so the progressives around the turn of the last century, 1890s, were seeking to have this kind of system. That's where the Federal Reserve System came from. And they wanted to control the money supply. They wanted to control the monetary system. And that would give them enormous control over the government eventually. And they started small and just built up until today it's just ridiculous. How can you protect a monetary system? Well, one thing is relate the value of money to the production of product and wealth. In other words, you say a country's value is not based upon how much gold it has, which is silly because that doesn't make any sense either. When you think about it, I mean, on an individual basis, it's okay to buy gold if you want to buy gold. But that's not, I'm talking about on a countrywide basis in that sense. Because when you run out of gold, you run out of economy, and you run out of money, and you can't have that. Because the economy, you want to grow. That's part of God's plan, is that life grows and the economy grows. And there's no end to growth. You can keep growing indefinitely. So what you need is a system of money that its value is dependent upon the real values or numbers of the gross domestic product, and that has to also be coupled with, in either very strong or sometimes moderate ways, depends, to the value of wealth or the standard of living of the people in that particular country. That then would give you a standard for the value of their, call it, dollar. A dollar is worth so much money. Wow. When you think about that, that kind of makes sense, doesn't it? And you can do this for every country on earth. And it would start correcting a lot of the issues, like the Chinese. Let's take the Chinese. Chinese love to devalue their dollar. The yen. They wanted to devalue. It's not the yen. I think that's a wrong country. Sorry about that. But whatever it is, they wanted to devalue their dollar, and so they take their money, and they just arbitrarily control it, and they say, well, it's worth this much, it's worth that much, but it really isn't. Now, if you use the system I just came up with, their standard of living is like a third of the U.S. Okay. And then you take the standard of living, and then you take that in comparison to the gross domestic product, which relative to the U.S. is quite high, and you start averaging these things out, and you can start actually coming up with a means of determining what their dollar is. Again, talking only in terms of relativist terms, versus ours. And now all countries have a real value to their money, including us. And if a country screws off, like Greece did, you know, and they start printing a lot of money, and then their money becomes almost worthless, and they have bouts of inflation, and then they have recessions and terrible things going on. All of that then weighs on the value of their money. And it gives us an opportunity for being able to then determine realistically how to do business with them and how much of their money they need to pay for something that we have. Now you can say, well, isn't that determined just by free market systems? It is if you don't have Federal Reserve banking systems and other falsehoods that change the normal free market system. But if you're going to prevent that from happening or correct it, you need to probably have at least an intermediate step. Well, a free market system, it can't be just put in place. You've got to correct all of the money supply systems that the world presently has because they're all mixed up and crazy. Because there's been so much abuse by governments in monkeying around with their money. And just so you know why you can't go back to gold, gold worked when governments were small. And there was sufficient gold to keep a standard of how much money supply a government needed to have meet the needs of its economy. But there isn't enough gold, even near enough gold, to do that, say, in the United States. The United States has an economy of about $3 or $4 trillion. Well, there's less than $1 trillion worth of gold in the whole country. So then what are you going to do? Well, you just ran out of money. I guess we'll have to stop buying things and have to stop doing anything. And you can't do that. See, that's the reason gold doesn't work as a standard. I know some people are big about that. And there are some advantages, truly, if you were small enough. Or if we had enough gold, I guess. But that's really not the solution. The solution is that it has to be, it's based upon time and energy. Remember, money is a compressed time and energy. So when you go back to the definition of the model, you can change that definition to make a much freer economy for everybody. And everybody enjoys then the benefits of that freer economy. I think it's terrific. And we can really make this work if we tried. And you could even incorporate what I just suggested, even in a bill of monetary rights or some, you know, some new article to the Constitution, not article, but some new amendment to the Constitution. Something that you say, well, this is the way we're going to, from now on, have our money, so it's honest. It's honest to ourselves. It's honest to those we trade with. It also sets a standard for the world, and the whole world will come around to this kind of thinking, and we have a much cleaner method of functioning with other countries. A lot more stability. And instability is what leads to all these crazy things that we see going on in the countries that are failing right now. All right, so what can we do about countries that are in the worst shape, you know, like Spain, Greece, and those countries that are still democracies, but they have built into them some serious problems from an overly broad socialistic agenda with handouts to so many different people. Well, if we're going to change those people, we need to be going in the opposite direction ourselves and show the world that a true free economy works, because otherwise they're not going to believe us. They're not going to follow us.
Hi, everyone. This is Seth at BBS Radio. Stay tuned for Why Life Is. We're going to see if we can clean this up and get him right back on the air. Thank you for your patience.
Giving you all my desire. Give my desire to you. Speaking of all those things you told. Maybe I'll just let you touch me, giving you all my desire. I'll get my point across now, and maybe you'll understand. Well, I said I'd make it if you tried, but I lied. My disguise is my high. Get to the top. Well, I know. Maybe I'll just let you touch me. Giving you all my desire. I'll get my point across now, and maybe you'll understand. Maybe I'll just let you lie to me. Maybe I'll act like I understand. Maybe I'll love and just run away and let you come find me again.
Okay, I'm back on again. Been an eventful night. Live radio, isn't it something? Yeah, what we've got here is in the studio where I'm at, there seems to be a loose cable, loose connection, and that seems to be causing the problem. And so we're kind of living with it and doing what I can. I mean, to correct it, truly, we'd have to take the whole thing apart, and so I'm just going to do the best I can. And hopefully we can make it for the next 8 minutes or so, or whatever we got left here. So let me continue on. All right. So if we got these countries now that need our help, and they need everybody's help, the first thing they need to do is to wake up to a different philosophy, including the people that are rioting in the streets, etc., is to give them some hope. And you can give them hope by making a structured plan of moving back to a free market system. And you show them step by step how each step will cause some maybe uncomfort or discomfort and some improvement, and how the improvement is always going to be moving in the right direction for them, and the amount of discomfort is going to be relatively small. And I think that this can be designed for each country. You can't do it on a mass level. You have to look at how they screwed themselves up with collectivism, usually with way, way too many collective bargaining situations between themselves and private and public institutions. Yeah, the labor union. You really almost have to stop the labor union, particularly in those countries, and start it again based upon an individualism that I suggested earlier in the show, showing people that if you do this, you know what? The people who work hard survive, and the people who don't want to work so hard, well, they got what they got. And it will help people to see that their efforts will be somewhat rewarded, and they'll get somewhere in what they're doing. And I can see my board's going crazy again here, so I don't know how much longer I'm going to be able to stay on. Yes, things are going nutty here. I'll try to turn it down and see if that helps. Okay, so at this point, all I can suggest is that if we're going to make improvements in ourselves, we also can be making or helping to make models in other countries to solve their individual problems. We shouldn't just ignore the world, because remember, the economy is everybody. It's not just a country. Just as I explained at the beginning of the show, if we ignore the rest of the world, we fail too. Yeah, it's true. It may take a long time because we're so big, but we can't live in a world where everybody else is going down the tubes, just as they can't live if we're going down the tubes. So we all have to work together, but not for collectivism, but individual development of each person's maximum abilities and maximum contributions, and to what they choose to live, not to what we say they should or they can or they must, but to what they choose. So a free economy leads to people who are more godly, and to a world in which you can see and appreciate God in every aspect of life while you're physically alive. It may not be important or very important when you go to the astral world, but it is certainly important while we're physically alive, because it leads to cooperation and sharing, which is what we need to learn while we are physically alive. And more than learning, we have to learn how to co-create it so that it becomes part of this dimension. You see, originally, when we came into this dimension as human beings, we came into a dimension with incredible resistance to this entire concept. Energy, even as it existed in its most base form, wanted to have nothing to do with cooperation and sharing. It wanted only to collectively become bigger and bigger and bigger. We call it gravity. But that's all it ever wanted to do. And energy is really the foundation of what's taking place in the physical realm. It is the, like, primary aspect of what affects what and how we do everything. So if we're going to choose to live a more spiritual life, we have to bring ourselves to a different level of, we'll say, using and sharing energy. I'm not just talking about oil or gasoline or any of that stuff. I'm talking about energy in all forms, including material forms. But it doesn't mean you give to people what they want. You help people to gain what they need by learning to be independent and self-created and self-creative with others. This is an important element of how and why we're here. So for protesters who are running around saying, I want to have, because I want to have free education, and when I get my degree, I want to not have to work and get paid as much as people who do work, and it shouldn't matter whether I choose to work or not, those folks have a lot of awakening to do and a lot of maturity to gain. And we shouldn't take away the opportunity for them to suffer in the process, because if they do, they become realistic in their understanding of themselves and their relationship to everybody else. And instead of being selfish, they are asset first to themselves, because they become willing to develop a realistic and a caring and loving attitude, and at the same time, instead of a selfish one, which is the other way that they're choosing to look at it, and at the same time, the rest of the world continues to grow without having these folks dragging on them and wanting their hands out all the time for something free. I don't care if it's health insurance or if it's a tax rebate or free education or somebody giving them food and shelter. It makes no difference. All those things are only handicaps for them, because they can't become their souls while they're taking from everybody else. When you take, you lose consciousness, and you become more and more personally involved with the world, but less a soul. And that's an important thing to consider if we really want our world to turn out the way we like it to, which is everybody functioning as a soul. It would be a wonderful place. Well, again, my board's going crazy here, too, so I'm going to probably sign off at this point. And thank you for putting up with all the technical problems we've had tonight. I think I know what it's going to take to fix it, and next week it should be a little easier to listen to the show without all these interruptions and crackling, etc. So until next week, this has been Niles McFarlane for My Life Is.